I don't know about you, but growing up, one of the things that I loved doing was run errands with my parents. And I'll never forget this. When I was around third or fourth grade, my mom wanted to go to a little mini mart down the street to grab something really quick. So I said, "Mom, can I go with you?" And she said, "Of course." So I hop in the car and I go with her. And we go into the little grocery store and we're walking around and I decide to wander a little bit. And I happen to end up in an aisle of potato chips, my favorite aisle of the store. And some of you can resonate with that. And before I knew it, in my hand were a bag of my favorite potato chips. Were really not potatoes, but they were called Cheetos. And I grabbed the Cheetos and I run to my mom and I said, "Mom, could I please have these Cheetos?" And she said no. And like a good third grader, I asked five times, "Mom, can I have these Cheetos?" And she said no five more times. And I ended up walking back to put it back on the shelf. But as I was walking back, I had a brilliant idea. The brilliant idea was to run out and just head, I don't actually know where I was going to go, maybe to the car, but I ran out the door, and before I also knew it, the owner of the store chased after me. My mom soon followed, and I ended up giving the bag of Cheetos back. The store owner was gracious, where it was no problem. My mom made me apologize. The worst part was getting into that car. And I knew that as I got into that car, it was going to be the longest five-minute drive ever. And in that ride, I knew that it was either going to be a long lecture of how I made a big mistake, it was going to be my mom shouting, saying how disappointed she was, or tell me how much trouble I'm in and tell me how I'm grounded, or this might age me a little bit, I can't play my brand new Nintendo. Not the two, not the latest one, but literally the Nintendo, the original one. And so I got in the car, and I was waiting, and waiting, and waiting some more. And before I knew it, it was just utter silence in the entire car ride home. Now, I don't know about you, but at that moment, I much would have preferred being yelled at or being disappointed with or telling me how much trouble I'm in. I would much prefer that than to be sitting in the car in utter silence. And it was at that moment I realized that silence possesses the power to be so deafening. And maybe many of us, we've experienced this before. And the reality is, this is kind of bad news for us here in the West. We have a little bit of a complicated relationship with silence, don't we? There's a few things that silence promotes in our souls, in our minds. Number one, silence can oftentimes feel like a punishment. We even have a word for something like this. When someone's angry with you, they give you what? They give you the silent treatment. We all know that. Punitive punishment. If not being punished, we feel like we're powerless. Like all we can do is just sit and wait because there's nothing, no information, no nothing telling us what step to make, no noise, no information. And so either we feel punished or we feel powerless. And I'll tell you what, in an age where we're increasingly becoming an on-demand kind of people, waiting and in silence is becoming more impossible. I mean, I don't know if you're like me, but if I'm hungry, I don't even have to get up from my couch. I can just pull out my phone, go on Uber Eats or DoorDash, and order my favorite meal from Chipotle. If I need a ride, I don't even have to drive. I, again, pull out my phone. If I need information, I don't have to wait. I don't have to read anything. I just pull out my phone. Nowadays, if one wants to meet somebody special, they don't have to go out. They don't have to have conversation. Again, they can just go on an app and start swiping left or right and find their lifelong partner. On-demand kind of world. And if we don't feel punished by silence, if we don't feel powerless, I would say this is the worst part. We feel abandoned. I mean, have you ever felt alone in a room? Even in a crowded room, have you ever been inside and you just feel alone because no one's talking with you? There's no conversation, there's no discussion. Silence can oftentimes feel like abandonment. And I know that for many of us, especially if you're a follower of Jesus, or maybe you're not, you've experienced all these things with God. And again, with this many people in the congregation, I can almost guarantee that there's people in this room who've walked in this morning, who've prayed this prayer: God, where are you? God, I need you. God, why is this happening to me? God, why have you abandoned me? God, why are you silent? Maybe it was a health diagnosis. Maybe it's a crisis in our finances. Maybe it's relational brokenness. Maybe it's a barrier between you and your children. Maybe it's an addiction or whatever it is. We pray and we say, God, where are you? And we are met with silence. And in that silence, we can only come to the conclusion, are we being punished? Am I being punished? God, are you distant from me? God, have you abandoned me? I feel so powerless. Many of us, we've experienced this. And the problem with this is what I call, we enter into this cycle of anxiety. And here's what this cycle of anxiety looks like. And I drew up a little board with you. We experience silence. God, where are you? And then I don't know about you, but whenever we feel this anxiety from silence, we move to catastrophe or catastrophizing. If we don't know the end of a story, we make up a bad ending to the story in our minds because a bad ending to the story is still better than no ending to the story at all. So we imagine the worst case scenario. I remember when I was first wooing my wife, Maria. And a friend introduced us, and as the young folks say, I slid into her DMs, which means I started messaging her, and I remember just asking her questions like, how was your day? And her response, and I was imagining her saying, give me this whole long list, and then she's asking me something, but her response was, good. Period. And then I remember looking at it and just saying, okay, that's it? You're not going to say anything else? You hate me. You don't ever want to see me. I disgust you. You don't want to date me or whatever it is. Our mind starts to catastrophize in our anxiety. And when we're anxious and we catastrophize, then we move on to self-soothing, or I would even say idolatry, where we find what I would call God substitutes. Well, money will fix this. Well, a relationship will fix this. Upward mobility will fix this. Addiction will fix this. Watching stuff on the internet that's inappropriate will fix this. Whatever it is, we find these self-soothing methods that eventually start to disappoint us. And then we actually start that cycle all over again. We go from silence to catastrophe to idolatry to disappointment. A good example of this is Moses, and I won't unpack the whole story of Moses, but Moses, who was the representative of God to the Israelites, goes up to Mount Sinai to hear from God. And at this one story in Exodus 32, here's what happens. It says, when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered around Aaron and said to him, come make gods for us who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And so apparently Moses was taking too long on top of Mount Sinai, and so the people started panicking. They started getting anxious. They started catastrophizing, and so they had to build their own god. And we all know how that turned out. Not very good. And oftentimes we're like Moses, who quickly forget. I love the verse where it says, Moses, the man who brought us out of Egypt. So they know cognitively that Moses rescued them out of slavery, headed towards the promised land. And yet even knowing that, because he was gone, he was silent, he was away, they began to panic in anxiety and start to build their own God. And many of us, we do just that. Now, all throughout the families of God, throughout the Old Testament, and even throughout the New Testament, we see failure after failure of God's own people. And then we get to the story of Jacob, who ultimately has failures of his own. And for the last several weeks, I can't unpack the entire story again. If you haven't been here, I really encourage you to go on our YouTube or our podcast and listen to the story of Jacob wrestling with God or this angel of God. But as we look into that passage, there's a verse that I do not want us to miss. And the verse is in verse 32, 29. It says this, when Jacob asked him, this is after they wrestled all night, Jacob says, please tell me your name. But God says, why is it that you ask my name? And there he blessed him. Now, sure, we can read this story and see that Jacob was blessed because God is faithful, always faithful, no matter what. We know that. So, yes, God blesses Jacob. But if we unpack this for a little bit, let's take a look at the situation that Jacob was in. Number one, I would say this, Jacob was alone. Jacob was alone. In verse 32 to 24, it says, after he had sent them across the stream, his whole family and all his possessions, he sent over all his possessions. And in verse 24, it says, so Jacob was left alone. So Jacob was going back to his hometown. And on his way, he wrestles God. But you have to understand that Jacob was all by himself. He sent his family and his possessions ahead. And he was left to confront God and the angel and have this wrestling match. And he was all alone. And now, not only was he all alone, but number two, he was in fear for his life. We all know that he was deceitful. He stole. He did his brother Esau very dirty. And he got word that Esau was after him with 400 men. And in Old Testament symbolism, 400 is symbolism for military might. And so what he understands is not only is he alone, his life is in jeopardy because his brother is after him with 400 men to kill him. And lastly, he's physically and emotionally and mentally drained. Now, for those of you that know me and have known me for a long time, know that I've always been a wrestler. I wrestled in middle school, high school, all throughout. And in high school, a wrestling match is 6 minutes long. And believe me, it's a very painful and long and exhausting 6 minutes. And to know that Jacob had this wrestling match with God till daybreak, you can imagine how exhausted and tired and in pain Jacob is in. And it's in this context where I can just imagine Jacob is going to God desperately saying, who are you? Please tell me your name. And the word please is just a help from our English translator to denote how desperate Jacob was to know. And the word tell is this Hebrew word, nagah. And nagah doesn't just mean to say a word, but it's this notion of conspicuous, make known, declare, make clear to me. So basically he's saying to God, God, make clear to me who you are. God, declare to me who you are to me. Now, at this point, I believe God, Jacob knew that he had just wrestled God. So it wasn't like he didn't know, but what he was saying is, God, give me affirmation. God, tell me who you are. Tell me that things are going to be okay. God, I'm alone. Esau is going to kill me. I'm exhausted. All my family is sent ahead. God, you know what I'm going through. Tell me your name. Tell me who you are. I want to know. I need that affirmation. And God says, "Why do you ask?" Not the answer that Jacob probably wanted. You can call that silence, you can call that the wrong answer, but regardless of what you call it, it wasn't the answer that Jacob wanted in the midst of everything he was going through. Now, scholars aren't exactly sure why God would respond in the way that God did, but there's a story in Judges that might give us a clue. In Judges 13, there's a story about a man named Manoah, and kind of an obscure person. You may not ever have heard of him. That's okay. But Manoah was the father of someone who you might know. His name was Samson. Long hair, strong hair, you know, big tough guy. Manoah was his son. Now, before Samson was born, Manoah and his wife, who's unnamed, struggled to have children. His wife was barren. And an angel came to Manoah and his wife to say, "Well, in fact, you will have a child." And here's what Manoah says to this angel that approached him. "What is your name? So that we may honor you when your words come true, when my wife has a child." But the angel of the Lord said to him, "Oh, why do you ask my name? It is too wonderful." And the Hebrew word wonderful is pili. And it doesn't just mean, oh, it's great, it's wonderful. But there's also this notion of mystery. It's beyond comprehension. And so I look at this, and I look at the story of even Moses, and what does this mean? What does this tell us? Well, number one, I believe it tells us this, that sometimes God answers our prayers exactly the way we ask and when we want, and we've experienced that. When God approached Moses in the burning bush, Moses says, "What is your name?" And God answers, "I am that I am." A better translation would be, it's this continuous verb. "I will be who I need you to be." Again, it wasn't just saying, "Here is my name." It's affirmation of who I am for you. So it's not just, "I am that I am." It's, "I will be who you need me to be. I will do what you need me to do. That is my name." God answers right away. But sometimes God answers our prayers in his own time. Palil, it's a mystery of when. Do you know that tradition says that when the Israelites from Egypt went to Canaan, the land filled with milk and honey, it took them 40 years. And a lot of that 40 years is because there's wandering and there's left turn and bad turn. There's good times, there's bad times. There's this, there's doubt, there's everything else. And then 40 years later, they get to the promised land. Did you know that a direct route would have taken 11 days? 11 days. But see, scholars believe that had they taken the direct route, there would have been Egyptian military posts all throughout, and they would have been wiped out. And so God, in God's own wisdom, made them wander for 40 years, I would even say for protection, and they made it to the land filled with milk and honey. So sometimes God answers your prayers right away. Sometimes God answers our prayers, but in his own timing, and that timing is a mystery. Sometimes God doesn't answer our prayers at all. And that's beyond comprehension. But what we also realize is that an unanswered prayer is the answer to prayer. Sometimes what we pray for isn't always what's best, sometimes even hurtful. God knows that. And so many times an unanswered prayer is the answer to prayer that we prayed the whole time without us knowing it. And on the other side of patience, on the other side of faithfulness and obedience, God has something better for all of us. And so I look at this story. And so what is it exactly that we can learn from Jacob? What did Jacob do? And I would say this, if we can learn anything from Jacob, from this day forward, I would say this, Jacob remembered. Jacob remembered. In chapter 28, it says this, and the Lord stood beside him and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac, the land on which you lie, and I will give to you and to your offspring. And your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And all the families of the earth shall be blessed in you and in your offspring. Know that I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go and bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised. What I believe about Jacob is that Jacob, in his loneliness, Jacob remembered this promise. In his fear, Jacob remembered God's promise. In his hopelessness, Jacob remembered God's promise. In his exhaustion, Jacob remembered his promises. His promises to never leave him. The ways that God has blessed him and his family. And what we'll see is how God blessed his descendants moving forward. We see God's faithfulness again in Exodus as God rescues his people from slavery into, again, Canaan, the land filled with milk and honey. Jacob remembers and has a lot to be grateful for. And I bet if we look back in our lives, no matter how hard it is right now, and no matter how hard it will be with whatever you go through, I bet if we look at our lives in hindsight, objectively, we can think of a time that God has healed us of our illness. We can think of a time that God has provided for our needs. We can think of a time where God comforted our souls when it was in sorrow. When God loved us unconditionally, when we're drowning with shame, we can think of a time where God has forgiven us in mistakes that we've made that perhaps nobody else in the world knows about. And if nothing else, we can all look back and give thanks and remember that God sent his son, Jesus Christ, to die on the cross, to resurrect on the third day, which we call Easter Sunday, on our behalf, so we can have a relationship with God and have everlasting life. And I would say this, because of that fact alone, if God does nothing else for us from this day to the day I die, I can be thankful for the rest of my life. And I know that's true for many of us, if not all of us. Many of us, especially around the University of Washington, were familiar with this couple's relationship psychologist named John Gottman. And he wrote many books that even my wife and I have read. And John Gottman, he says this. He says, you know what? I can predict whether a couple will stay together within just 2 minutes of meeting them. And in the book, he says, why? You know, how do you do that? And he says, I ask two questions. How did you meet, and how did you feel about that? And he says this, even if a couple's been married for 30, 40, 50 years, if they can think back from the very beginning, no matter how much trouble they're in their marriage, if they think back and say, you know what, things are tough now, but, oh boy, when we first met, it was great. Oh, he was so handsome. Oh, she was so beautiful. Oh, he was so kind. If they remember with fondness and gladness, he says there's hope in the marriage. But he says if they look back and say, oh, it was horrible from the beginning. Oh, he's always been like this. She's always done this. Then there's trouble. If they remember with negativity and bitterness, there's trouble. Because you see, remembering, especially as followers of Jesus, brings strength in our weakness. Remembering brings God's hope in the most hopeless areas of our lives. Remembering brings God's joys when tears have overshadowed our experience. And I'll end with this. A couple years ago, I was pastoring at a church in Seattle, and I get a phone call. It was a Saturday morning. It was from a congregant. And I was like, man, it's Saturday morning. Why are you calling me? And I didn't want to answer, but there's something in my spirit that told me to answer, and I answered. And it was a family. It was a dad of a one-year-old. He said, Prentice, my son is dead. And I immediately get into my car. I drive to his house. The coroner's there. And we're just crying and crying. I meet with their family for the next couple weeks. We have a memorial. And I get the privilege to preside. And after we were done, I just give the dad and the mom a big hug, just in tears. And I'll never forget what dad said. He said, Prentice, I know that God loved my son. In the midst of pain and loss and grief, the hope that he had was he knows and remembers the love of God for his son. There's power in remembering. And so I want to give you a couple practices this week. Practice number one is to be still. And I would even offer on a weekly basis, take a Sabbath, a whole 24-hour period where you can just be still before God. Every day, take an opportunity to be still for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 30 minutes. I love what Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann says about this. He says, Sabbath, or being still, is being rebellious against the world. Because the world tells you, you gotta move, you gotta produce, you gotta work. And I just wanna say this with all respect and love, and I say this to myself, the world will move on with or without us. And so take just a few minutes to be still before God every day. And I give you this challenge, even for the next 2 weeks until Easter. Take 10, 15 minutes every day. And in that stillness, take an inventory of the ways that God has shown up. And I bet you, if we're that intentional, God will speak and God will remind us of the ways that he's come through for us. You see, silence can paralyze us with fear, but to remember gives us the courage to march on. Let's pray. God, thank you. And no matter what we bring to the table, you love us. You'll never leave us nor forsake us. Help us to remember that promise. Help us remember the ways that you've already come through for us, especially through your Son, Jesus Christ. And may that give us courage and boldness to move forward with hope, joy, and gladness forevermore. In your name I pray, amen.